Give the gift of liberty this holiday season by becoming a Cato sponsor on behalf of a friend or loved one. Visit cato.org/podcast sponsor. And if you support our work with $1,000 or more, I'll gladly give you or your designee a shout out on the Cato Daily Podcast. Help us advance the values of individual liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace by becoming a Cato podcast sponsor. The website, again, is cato.org/podcast sponsor. And thank you. This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, December 24th, 2018. I'm Caleb Brown. How has this president changed comedy? Has it gotten more lazy, or is it just too Herculean a task to be smart in poking fun at someone who at times appears to be a caricature of himself? Andrew Heaton is a comedian and host of the Something's Off podcast. We spoke last week. I can remember in the Obama years, Saturday Night Live had several really brilliant cold opens that poked fun at Democrats. And you would think, well, you know, that's it's good for this, you know, fairly left-wing comedy show to make fun of Democrats. Joe Biden was portrayed as this really outlandish. Jason Sudeikis was Joe Biden, and Obama leaves the White House, so it's Biden time, according to him. And he makes all these outlandish promises. Another cold open: Barack Obama goes to China, and through an interpreter, the president of China is insulting Barack Obama, like screaming at him. But the interpreter is trying to emote in the same way that the speaker was, and I thought a lot of those are super creative and very funny. They, of course, you know, take digs at Republicans all the time, but in the Trump era, it seems like, and maybe this is more broadly true or less broadly true, you can tell me, it seems like it's so easy a target and also so difficult a target at the same time, because Donald Trump sort of invites a lot of jokes at his expense. And I want to know from you and your perspective, what has happened to comedy?
Well, there's two things. See, I think it's actually much harder, both in the sense that the climate has changed and in the actual sense of making things funny. So in comedy, like you've probably read The Onion and look at The Onion, which is a great satirical publication, or remained so during the Trump years. When you look at that, exaggeration is a really key facet of humor. And it's difficult to do that with Donald Trump. If Donald Trump kicks off the morning by saying, you know, I'm going to hit golf balls at protesters from a battleship, and then I'm going to hang Rosie O'Donnell from a tree. And that, like, that's his promise at the beginning of the day, like 7 a.m., I will hang Rosie O'Donnell. Where do I go from there? It's very difficult for me to go, but how do I make this crazy? How do I make this wacky?
Right. The Onion, for example, in portraying Eric Trump and Donald Trump Jr., they, you know, with Joe Biden, they played him
Joe as, Biden was a sort of low-level Florida criminal.
Joe Biden was like
stealing copper.
A redneck with a Trans Am,
right,
who wore like jean shorts.
He was afraid legalized weed would cut into his business.
He got a lifetime ban from Dave and Buster's.
Yeah. With the Trump boys,
the sons of Donald Trump, the elder sons of Donald Trump, they're portrayed sort of as
wannabe Nancy Drew type thing.
I'm going to say Hardy Boys.
Yeah, Hardy Boys.
With like malice.
Yes.
Built in. But they're also bumbling in a Keystone Cops sort of way.
The Onion is fantastic, and the corollary to it, which I think is also telling of where humor should be going right now, is they've also got Clickhole, which is making fun of clickbait and everything like that, but it tends to have a much heavier dose of absurdity to it, which you're going to see rise in comedy over here in the next few years. I think right now we're kind of – humor does tend to be cyclical, and we're about at the Watergate moment where everybody is just angry and mad and cynical, and you're going to see Steve Martin kind of rise from those ashes using absurdity.
Because I remember Steve Martin saying that at the end of Watergate, just as he was beginning in comedy, he decided consciously, mm-hmm. I'm going to be silly.
Yeah. And I think that will ultimately do well. And I think that would do well. The weird thing right now is that we've kind of, as a people, we've all agreed that Donald Trump is our assignment editor. He gets to determine the news cycle every day. And when I listen to these late night talk shows, which have very talented people working on them, they do tend to be just a variation of Trump is a moron. Now, I agree, he is a moron. However, I've reached this conclusion several years ago, and you're not telling me anything new with that same joke over and over again. I think that you'll begin to see that kind of coming into absurdity is the next logical step. And I think that there would be an appetite for it if people were to do that. On my podcast that I'm doing, Something's Off with Andrew Heaton, I'm lending much more towards the absurdity than I am towards just kind of raking people that I'm mad about through the coals. I don't find that as funny. It kind of exhausts me.
Well, I saw a clip that your friend and mine, Lou Perez, put out, which was basically this is a promo for a stand-up special for a comedian who was so brave in taking on Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And that seems to me like the easiest and laziest thing to do, but there ought to be, and some outlets have proven that it's possible to make fun of a president that is, you know, highly polarizing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are ways to do it. There's certainly ways to be funny. There's certainly ways to make fun of Donald Trump. I would say in general, if you're starting out in comedy at home, don't make any Trump hair jokes. Those were really mined into oblivion in the 80s. Any communities that are built around Donald Trump hair jokes have really gone downhill. There's a big opioid problem with comedians trying to make fun of Donald Trump's hair. There are ways to do it, but I think in general they tend to be either lazy or the people that are engaging in them are so gripped by tribalism that they're just wanting to communicate, I hate this thing. And it's like, okay. But that's not necessarily funny. You need to make it amusing.
What is the relationship between the fact that, like, Stephen Colbert, for example, has made his bread and butter sort of ripping on Donald Trump? What do you make of the fact that, well, he's got two jobs, really, in terms of audiences that he has to please? One is the studio audience that is in New York or people from outside of New York who want to go see the Stephen Colbert show. Mm-hmm. And the people who are watching, or he hopes are watching, across the United States. Because it seems like the New York audience is very different from a couple of people sitting at home somewhere in America.
That's
a very
yeah.
different audience.
The New York audience, very clearly, if you listen to it, the New York audience is very enamored with clapping and applause, and you can go for both. So, something that The Daily Show used to do, it might still do. I don't mean this as a slight to The Daily Show, but a few years ago when they were codifying their practices, they had a rule that if the joke was intended to elicit applause, you would scrap it. That was not the purpose of the joke. The joke was to elicit humor. I think that that's something Colbert is struggling with. And I don't know that he's really trying to straddle that fence. I think he's pretty much gone towards he's going to go center, left, left. I think people that aren't super interested in politics or are Trump fans are probably watching Jimmy Fallon, who tends to be a lot more apolitical and less of a bite. I think you can be political. I think that's fine. I mean, I am a political satirist, so I don't think it's necessarily bad to go into politics. But I do think you have to be imaginative in the way you do it. I would say it would also help if you can hold back the anger and bile that you experience. I don't think that really is feeding anything particularly amusing right now. It's just making everybody angry.
Reading The Onion years ago, I remember one of the stories they had was Barack Obama urges Democrats at the Democratic National Convention to join him in creating 1,000 years of darkness. And the people were writhing around and, having orgies on the floor, the DNC. And it was basically a sort of a fever dream of conservative. They're portraying what a certain segment of conservatives or Republicans would view as, well, this is what he really wants. And I don't know how to it seems like a really vexing problem for comedians to do that with somebody who honestly does have these very polarizing, stark opinions that, at first blush often seem to be informed by his gut rather than evidence.
We are having to deal with the P.T. Barnum of American politics. And for good and for ill, that entails a high degree of showmanship that I do not need to levy. What I do on my shows, I really just don't deal with Trump that much. And it's not because, as I said earlier, I resent having him as my assignment editor. And I won't allow my day to be dictated by Donald Trump. I won't allow my emotions to be dictated by Donald Trump. I really, this year for Christmas, I should get all of my progressive friends some Seneca and just be like, please read Stoicism.
I was about to say that.
You will feel better, I promise you. Just read a little bit of this. So I tend to not deal with Donald Trump that much. When I do, it's – I don't know. I think the people around him are a lot more fun to play with. Like I'll probably do a sketch on my podcast, if not this week, come the new year, where I've written out this entire itinerary of – it's just a day in the life of Mike Pence. And every 8.5 minutes, he's checking to see if the president's dead. And that I think you can kind of develop kind of an Onion-esque character with. It's a little bit harder to do with Trump just because he's so massive in terms of his cultural weight that I don't know that it's – I don't find him fun to deal with. But I do think there's tons of – I mean you brought up the Onion a moment ago. I think South Park's also done a wonderful job. Anything that takes itself very seriously is always a target for humor. Anything that is condescending and veers towards being kind of pompous is a wonderful target for humor. South Park's great at that. And South Park is, I think, kind of anarchic in that capacity because it doesn't have a political party that's home base. It just wants to take a whack at anybody that's on top of a soapbox. And The Onion, which clearly has a left-leaning bias, I think is nonetheless magnificent in being able to tackle that kind of stuff and not come off as being highly hacky and partisan. I think it is a shame that The Onion has not had a Pulitzer. And I think – did Andy Borowitz get one? If he did, that should be stripped from him. He should be flogged in the streets to be pulled from him and given to The Onion.
Is – you know, you're talking about tribalism and it strikes me that there is a pretty large audience that you know, you want to be catered to as an audience. And yet comedy is surprise in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. And it's one of the ingredients,
and it also seems that there is an audience for. I'm not actually here for the comedy. I'm here for the 2 minutes hate.
Yes, there's definitely a. You've seen this last few years, and I think that comedy has suffered terribly for it. There are a lot of people that are going to have their opinions affirmed to them, and they're going to kind of is there's probably a German word for angry laughter. Like Chortlesausen or something, where you're just ah, ha, 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 and you're mad and angry. That's a thing. That said, though, I think that people are more exhausted than folks realize. I think that the edges of political discourse in America, the loud people at the edges are shouting everybody else down. I think there's a lot of people that I don't necessarily want to call them centrists or moderates, but I think there's a lot more nuanced people than we're generally given credit for that are not tub-thumping Republicans or tub-thumping Democrats, and there's a space that you could go there.
So the Chubbawumbas.
The Chubbawumbas. That is the technical term. I'll add to this because you brought up tribalism a moment ago. One of the things that I'm continually surprised by, and I shouldn't be at this point, but I'm continually surprised by as a comedian, is just how deep-set tribalism is in the human psyche. Going into stand-up, and I've been doing stand-up maybe 8-9 years now. I knew going into stand-up that everybody has a deep reaction to death and sex because even a monk has some primordial fear of sex or death, one of the two, but probably has some thoughts on it, right? And most people, if you're not a monk and you're not completely fine with dying, you're a little bit worried about dying. You're a little bit – you know, there's a little bit of tension around sex. So if you can develop a good joke involving mortality or reproduction, if you craft it well, it'll resonate. What I did not anticipate was that tribalism is even more intense than those two very intense human emotions are. And the only time I think I've ever really angered an audience, seriously angered them, is when I start kind of poking at the edges of that. I won't even do my version because I forgot it, but Jerry Seinfeld has a wonderful bit about, you know, why are you rooting for this particular team? Like none of the people are from your town. The owner's not from your town. Are you rooting for the jerseys? When I do those kind of jokes, it pisses people off. And they really get mad because people love being a part of a team and they want to hate this other team. And if you start to go, well, why? Like what are the boundaries of your team? What unites you other than hating that team? They do not like that.
Andrew Heaton is host of the Something's Off with Andrew Heaton podcast. The last-minute gift for the person who has everything, clearly it is a donation in the name of a friend or loved one to the Cato Institute. Discover the benefits of becoming a Cato sponsor by visiting cato.org/podcast sponsor and give the gift of liberty this holiday season.